Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why isn't the United States the healthiest country on earth? Although we spend the most per capita on medical treatment and supplies of any country in the world, our citizens tend to live sicker and die younger than those of Western Europe or Scandinavia. Those outcomes might cause us to look askance at the job our doctors, hospitals, and drug developers are doing. But as my guest today has discovered in a lengthy analysis of what countries spend to stay healthy, the problem may instead lie with our narrow definition of what health is. Lauren A. Taylor is a presidential scholar of public health and medical ethics at Harvard Divinity School and former program manager at the Yale Global Health Leadership Institute. Her new book, written with co-author Elizabeth H. Bradley, is called The American Healthcare Paradox: Why Spending More is Getting Us Less. She joins us today from the studios at Harvard University as part of KERA's Breakthroughs Initiative. Lauren, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much, Chris. It's such a pleasure to be here.
What is the common understanding in this country of what health actually means?
Sure. So I think in this country, we conceive of health quite narrowly, and we think of it primarily as an output of healthcare services and medical care. So you can see this in the investment pattern of the United States over many decades now. We continually invest aggressively and spend exorbitantly in healthcare services to build hospitals and pay physicians, buy medical technology, under the assumption that this will create health for the population.
So in other words, we turn to the medical system in order to get our health back when something has gone wrong.
Absolutely. And this is very different when Dr. Bradley and I traveled to other countries. We saw just how kind of uniquely American this phenomena is. In other countries, particularly in Europe and Scandinavia, where we spent the most time, they have a much broader conception of health that really rests on things that lie outside of the medical care system. So, of course, medicine plays a role. But for many Scandinavians, you know, food and exercise and air quality were all real things that they considered as influencing their health. And while I think we know, as Americans, we of course know these things on an intellectual level, when it comes down to investing for health, we always go back to medical care.
So, Lauren, we do have lots of messages about healthy diet and exercise and other things that fall into the realm of personal responsibility, according to sort of the American way of looking at things. How does that relate to our assumption that health is an individual good rather than a collective one?
Absolutely. You've hit on a key tenet that we explore in the book, and, you know, it's a tough issue. So, of course, in this country, we have a rich history of individualism. I think going all the way back to the Westerns, you know, we really like to think that we can be self-reliant. And so health is largely conceived of then as a product that you create for yourself or you go out and buy in the market. You and your physician have a one-to-one individual relationship that can beget health for you. And in other countries, again, this just is not the case. It's conceived in a much more collective way. And as a result, the national investment strategy reflects that. So health is definitely, population health is prioritized in other countries, whereas kind of individual health, I think, is the focus of a lot of health policy here.
So this is really interesting. On what measurements of overall health does the United States lag behind other developed democracies?
Sure. So many of the large population health metrics that so often define the development stage of a country are ones where we actually do so poorly. So, for instance, we are at or near the bottom of the OECD in maternal mortality. We're at or near the bottom. We rank 28th out of 34 in low birth weight infants, 31st out of 34 in infant mortality, and 26th out of 34 in life expectancy. So these are huge, you know, metrics that really do reflect the quality of health on a national level, and yet we're really not getting what we, I think, should expect for the 17% of GDP that we're investing.
And how much money is spent per American per year specifically on healthcare?
So by last estimates, and these vary, but I think we're right under, just a hair under $8,000 per person per year, $7,900 and something. And this is a third higher than any other OECD country. And OECD is the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development that does a great job collecting these statistics. And we're almost double the OECD average. So it's really, we are just spending a ton in medical care. Now, what the book goes into and what we found was that if you look at a broader spending accounts, and you take into consideration not only that healthcare spending, which is so often referenced in the press, but you say, well, what really creates a healthy population? If we take to heart that health is more of a collective good than we typically acknowledge, then maybe we should look at also social service spending. And so what we did is we looked across the OECD at both healthcare spending and social service spending in each country, and we found some really surprising results that set up the rest of our discussion, and they were twofold. One, the United States is no longer the top spender in the OECD among industrialized countries when you look at both healthcare spending and social services together. France, Sweden, Austria, Switzerland, Denmark all outspend us. In addition, the United States spends in a pretty unique way, and that is we invest twice as much in our healthcare spending as we do in our social service spending. So it's a 2-to-1 ratio favoring healthcare. Most of the top performers, the real stars of the OECD who are ranked, you know, first, second, third in those metrics I mentioned earlier, are spending almost in an inverse way, twice as much in social service as healthcare. And so what we took from this is, you know, an affirmation that health really is kind of a collective good, or at least has a collective dimension that needs attending to, and that, you know, maybe you can spend in a different way, or we could spend our money in a different way and get better health outcomes for the population.
So it's not necessarily that on top of spending $8,000 per capita per year on healthcare, we need to add additional spending on social services. We might be able to reduce medical spending if we increased social spending.
I think that's one way to look at it. Another way to look at it would be, you know, particularly given how much waste most studies estimate there is in the medical care system, you know, much of it is created by a medicalization, a treating of social and behavioral and economic problems as medical ones. If we could really work to address some of that waste, I think that could free up some resources to allow the healthcare system to be more responsive to some of these social concerns that a social service industry would typically address. But, of course, we need kind of an American way to address this. And I think for good reason, there is a long legacy of being hesitant about expansion of social services in this country. So I think there are a couple ways to approach this where the U.S. could pay more attention or invest more in these social services. And it doesn't necessarily need to be a big government expansion of, you know, name your favorite social service. It could be done in other ways.
Can you give us an example of what is at heart a social problem being treated like a medical problem in this country?
Sure. So the one I often give is that if you go to most emergency departments, particularly in urban areas on a cold winter night, you'll find many people who have turned up in the emergency department simply because they don't have another place to go. They don't have adequate shelter, they're homeless or in a transitional state, and yet people know the emergency room always will have lights on, it will be warm, they can speak to people, and so those people take themselves to the emergency room or they call an ambulance and are taken to the emergency room. And there are many examples of this. That is, I think, the simplest and clearest. But part of our work was going out and speaking to frontline healthcare providers. And so they told us ad nauseum, you know, there's just so much coming through the doors, not only of the emergency room, but of primary care doctor's offices, that is not really medical in nature. And yet here our healthcare providers are having to, you know, really try and address it, these issues, with whatever tools they have. And those tools are very expensive medical tools. That's, you know, MRIs and that's inpatient admissions, because that's the tools they have. So I think that's a good example of how the United States has really medicalized some of these issues and tried to throw medicine at them. And I think the proof is in the pudding. You know, our healthcare spending continues to go up and up and up, and our health outcomes are not getting much better.
What is the health relationship between a social good like childcare subsidies or transportation The relationship between that and healthcare and overall health outcomes, excuse me.
Sure. So I think transportation is a really key one. I think, you know, lack of transportation, I'm not sure, is being addressed directly or medicalized directly. But when someone doesn't have transportation to get to physician's appointments, their health degrades. It gets worse. By the time they actually get there, they call an ambulance, their health is worse. Treating it is more expensive. Often it's in a more intensive environment like a hospital as opposed to a doctor's office. And so there were many people who we spoke to who said transportation is the place to start. I mean, it's just so essential. We've built all of this healthcare infrastructure, but it's not particularly community-based, meaning it doesn't travel. The healthcare infrastructure and the staff stay stationary. And we expect people to come to us, meaning healthcare providers. So if they don't have transportation, they can't get to us, and their health continues to get worse and worse and worse. And down the line, that becomes more and more expensive.
So no one set out to create a system where we spent a whole lot of money and didn't get much in return. Can you talk a little bit about the evolution of our really bifurcated healthcare system and social welfare system?
Sure. Of course, no one set out to have a lousy system. I think what happened is that these systems, it's important to recognize that to call the American healthcare system a system is in many ways a misnomer because it wasn't planned as it was in many other countries. You know, if you have a single payer, you can say, okay, healthcare system of Austria starts today, and this is how it will work. Here, we had a much more organic growth, and medicine in particular started as a cottage industry. You know, physicians were trained to varying degrees in the late 19th century. They would hang a plaque outside their door and say, I'm a doctor, come and see me. And so these are the roots. It was not particularly regulated, and they were really viewed as community entrepreneurs. And so they made their own money, and they reinvested it in whatever they had. But this was the model. Physicians were entrepreneurs, and so that has stayed with us in many ways. And the legacy of that and the interest of Americans in free markets and competition for the purposes of driving innovation has really stayed with us. And so you see a lot of protection now in health policy debates around keeping physicians as kind of entrepreneurs as opposed to, say, civil servants as they're viewed in other places where the system was more deliberately thought out. We'll pay physicians X, they will perform the following, and they will be paid the following. Here, you know, it's kind of dependent on however you want to run your business. So one physician will accept all insurance, another will accept only these, and they, to some extent, get to set their own rules. So I think that's very different than we see in other countries. The social services, however, have developed more of a top-down approach. You know, providing adequate housing for vulnerable people has almost always been considered the responsibility of the state. There has been some charity and some nonprofit work that has always kind of pitched in along the way, but it's largely been a state-based enterprise. So you can see that the origins are just very different. And so those origins have stayed with us as these two sectors have developed and really create huge challenges to integrating them now.
Lauren A. Taylor is my guest. She's a presidential scholar of public health and medical ethics at Harvard Divinity School. Her new book, written with co-author Elizabeth H. Bradley, is called The American Healthcare Paradox: Why Spending More is Getting Us Less. If you'd like to ask a question or weigh in on the discussion, you can call now to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Lauren A. Taylor, a presidential scholar of public health and medical ethics at Harvard Divinity School and former program manager at the Yale Global Health Leadership Institute. Her new book, written with Elizabeth H. Bradley, is called The American Healthcare Paradox: Why Spending More is Getting Us Less. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. Lauren, is one of the impediments to even attempting to spend more on social services and see what that gets us in terms of health outcomes, is one of the impediments that many people tend to associate social spending, social welfare spending, with the poor, however they might classify that category of individuals?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we've come up against this a number of times in presenting these findings. People feel like, oh, you know, you Northeastern liberals, you just want to spend more on the poor, quote unquote. But actually, I don't think that's the case. I think we all have need for social services in one way or another. And they may not, as I've said before, they may not be government funded. They may be community provided. I think the takeaway from this research is that attention to the social determinants of health, by which I mean the non-medical determinants of health, can really get you a long way. And how each country decides to pay that attention can be totally different. So, yes, in the analysis, countries that spent more on social services, quote unquote, did better. But in places like Scandinavia, those social services are not just for the poor. They're for everyone. You know, in Finland, if you have a baby, the government sends you a baby box complete with, you know, a few outfits for the baby and pacifiers and formula. And that is not just limited to a bottom quintile of the socioeconomic continuum. That is everyone. So other countries have definitely mobilized social services to be for everyone. And I think we could do the same here. It is not just a matter of the poor. I would add that people often wonder if maybe our health outcomes lag in this country because we just have an uninsured population that is particularly sick. And we hear this argument a lot. But actually, when you control for education and socioeconomic status, even white, educated, fairly well-to-do Americans trail their European peers in a number of health outcomes. So really, there's something global about the impact of the social determinants of health that we have not fully, I think, appreciated and acted on.
Many people worry, and perhaps understandably so, about creating a culture of dependency if we expand social services. But the book makes the point that providing for the health and well-being of a large swath of the population ultimately fuels a kind of independence that's not possible if they are homesick.
Absolutely. Yes. And I think the concern about dependency is a good one, and of course one that's been with us for many, many years. I think it's important to recognize that, you know, we are interdependent on one another for our health in a number of ways. You know, there's a great article out right now, I think, in The Nation about this fairly famous journalist getting whooping cough, and she attributes it to a rise in people not having their children vaccinated. And so that's a very clear example how my health is dependent upon your health decisions. I think in addition, we often overlook that, you know, my healthcare bills are dependent on your healthcare decisions. So I am definitely paying one way or another if you are using a lot of healthcare resources. I'm paying because we're in a risk pool together in an insurance plan, and so I pay through my premiums. I also pay through my taxes. I also pay just because if there's a procedure that's being demanded a lot in the free market, that means the price goes up. And so I think the interdependence of our actual health and our interdependence of our healthcare financing is really often shortchanged in the dialogue. And so, of course, we don't want to engender broad-based dependence on anyone, government or what have you. But I think recognizing certain interdependencies that really are there is critical.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to the phones now and speak with Sandy. Hello, Sandy.
Hi.
Hi. Go right ahead, please.
I was interested in the comment that Ms. Taylor made about a transportation system to reduce costs. Otherwise, the cost just escalates. I have two children that are physicians. Both of them have closed their clinics. One's become a professor for medical, but the other one has gone back for emergency rescue and paramedic. And so often the calls that they get are for just a simple lift assist or an emergency run to the emergency room, and it's only because they don't have transportation to get there. And it's a huge amount of cost for something that could so much easier or so much less expensively be dealt with.
Sounds like what you were talking about earlier, Lauren. Do you want to respond to that?
Absolutely. Just to say thank you for the call and thank you for the insight. I think you're exactly right. And I think there are many issues like this where, again, we see a medicalization of kind of a social issue. The social issue is this person doesn't have transportation to get to the pharmacy or to get the refill of insulin. And so because we have such a massive healthcare infrastructure that is actually available in some quirky ways, people can call and get an ambulance to provide that transportation, and that ambulance is exorbitantly expensive. And in many cases, again, we, the collective we, are paying for that ambulance. And so thank you, Sandy, for the insight. I, of course, agree.
We have an email here from Leonard in Arlington who writes, I submit we don't have a health care system, rather a health repair system. In other words, we spend a great deal of money and resources to fix what's gone wrong medically, but almost none to prevent the situation in the first place. What can be done to change this paradigm?
Oh, it's a great question, Leonard, and I think it is the question that a lot of people are talking about. As you said, you know, really our healthcare system, quote unquote, is designed to wait until people get sick and come to them. And of course, we would prefer something that worked further upstream, if you will. And I think that's exactly the argument that the book is making. How to do it is really a challenge. And I think it has a lot to do with changing an incentive structure that is really deeply embedded. Right now, we pay physicians and all of our healthcare workforce largely on the basis of volume, how many procedures they do. And to some extent, we're starting to pay them on the basis of some quality metrics, but those quality metrics are almost always still related to the quality of care delivered inside the healthcare or medical infrastructure. So how many of the patients in a hospital receive beta blockers if they meet such and such standards on a blood test? So it's still all quite medical, and it's all about people who are already in the system, so presumably sick. The question of how to transform those incentives is really one that cuts very deep into, I think, a number of the historical legacies that we spoke about earlier, Chris, and some real kind of cultural underpinnings. You know, like I said, the current structure and incentives support this individual view of medicine, that I go out and buy health and pursue health on an individual level. To say, okay, now we're going to reward you or structure a system on the basis of keeping people healthy, you know, how do you measure health? You're kind of trying to measure an adverse, a null outcome. If someone doesn't come to the hospital, how do we reward the hospital for keeping that person out of its doors? And so these are big questions that certainly are going to require a lot of policy work down the line, but I think up front require a real renewed discussion around what we expect of our healthcare system and in some ways what we're willing to pay for that, both financially and otherwise.
What do you say to the argument that many people will raise that, look, a lot of this preventive stuff just falls on the individual? You choose to eat foods that are good. You choose not to smoke. You choose to exercise. All of those things, you know, in one way of looking at this problem, seem like entirely personal decisions rather than anything affected by the broader society.
Yeah, I understand that argument, but I would respond by saying, of course, we know that you are much, much more likely to smoke if you live in a house of smokers. Mm. You are much more likely to be overweight if your kind of immediate friend group is overweight. So I think while there is an individual component, at the end of the day, we make the choice. We shouldn't neglect the strong social influence that exists even on some of those most basic individual health behaviors. I would also say that even if it were true that, you know, you make that choice entirely independently, like I said, I'm paying for that choice. So it's in my interest to try and get you to choose differently.
Can you talk about the link between educational attainment and overall health, which transcends even the relationship between educational attainment, as I understand it, and an income?
Yep, it does. You know, I promised myself that I wouldn't speak too far outside my area of expertise, and I'm trying to model that. So this is not an area that I know an exorbitant amount. I haven't authored these studies. I've just read them. Mm-hmm. So education is, I think, the number one, you know, across everything. How healthy are you going to be? Your education level is often the biggest predictor. And certainly early childhood education is a major influencer. I won't say too much more than that because I don't want to offend any of the brilliant educational scholars out there who are more versed in this than I am, but it's certainly essential.
But to the extent that education is a social good, it is something that, from your perspective, ought to be encouraged and
absolutely
supported.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next on the phone to Michael in Dallas. Hey, Michael.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've always had a question about why there are two different types of insurance with regards to medical and dental. Dental seems to be very important to a person's health and well-being, and yet it's a separate policy.
I don't know if that's – have you looked into that, Lauren?
I haven't. It's a great question. I would love to know the answer myself. And, Michael, you know what? Any of these questions that folks call in with, and they're great questions that I can't answer, I would just encourage you to check out the website, theamericanhealthcareparadox.com, and there's an email there. And if you email me afterwards, I promise to get back to you with a more informed response. But it's a fabulous question. I'm not sure. And dental is critical. Many of the things that start as dental problems, when not addressed, for out of a necessity because there is no health insurance or someone doesn't have coverage, become major health events. So, of course, that fits within the rubric of thinking upstream and in a preventative manner.
What did doctors tell you they would like to see in order to really help their patients beyond whatever treatments they can apply or medications they can prescribe?
Doctors and actually the entirety of the healthcare workforce. We spoke not only to doctors, but to nurses, pharmacists, you know, the range, healthcare administrators, hospital administrators, virtually all said, we need more help. We can't address the problems that are coming in the door. And in fact, we're trying to address the problems and doing a poor job of it, and it's costing a ton of money. So this took a number of forms. You know, the things that they wanted to see done was, of course, more social workers in the hospital, greater collaboration with community infrastructures and partnerships with kind of social service agencies who work outside the healthcare system. And those partnerships are definitely difficult to establish. You know, in the same breath that they said, I'd love to have a social worker here, they reference, but, you know, costs are being cut across the system. We're in this massive effort to control healthcare costs, so no one has money to hire that social worker. Mm. And partnering across sectors, healthcare to social services, healthcare to kind of community nonprofits, is really difficult. You know, as we spoke about earlier, the origins of those two sectors are quite different, and they still hold many of the characteristics of the early days. So hospitals, you know, would love to be able to discharge someone to a community organization, and yet if it's 2 o'clock in the morning on Saturday and someone is ready to leave the ED, there's no one at that community center necessarily to receive that person and to manage the care on the outside. So on a very practical level, the collaboration across healthcare and social services is a challenge, but unequivocally, it was something that doctors and the rest of the healthcare workforce said they needed.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Hasid on the line in Plano. Hello, Hasid.
Hey, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a quick question. It was kind of along the lines of what you were discussing earlier. You had said that a more holistic, I guess, health system would be preferable, you know, to avoid a lot of the illnesses and ailments that a lot of people suffer from, you know, like high blood pressure, heart disease, diabetes, things like that. Now, a lot of people are promoting things like that, you know, like exercising, eating well, things like that. But the opponents will stand up and cry foul and say that, you know, you're violating our personal freedoms and, you know, enacting the whole nanny state debate. And just to be clear, I'm actually in support of a more holistic healthcare system. But what would be, I guess, your counter argument to the opponents?
Thanks for your call.
Yep. Sorry, I'm scribbling down here notes. Thank you so much, Hasid, for calling in. Yes, I think the word holistic is actually a great word to use. It's one we use in the book often, and that is definitely something that I would love to see the system trend towards. You know, I think the argument in response to, you know, the nanny state comment would be twofold. One, this holistic approach can save money. And at the end of the day, I think that is the strongest argument. You know, the data really is convincing. I think that investing in these upstream determinants can prevent downstream kind of medical catastrophes that are very expensive. 70% of stroke, 80% of heart disease are thought to be caused by social and behavioral factors, not medical ones. And so I think there's really strong evidence that if we are in crisis mode, as we seem to be, about healthcare spending, that this is worth a shot. I would also respond that, you know, there's nothing in the book and there's nothing in my perspective necessarily that says that the government is the one that needs to take accountability for creating this more holistic approach to health. This can be done on a community basis, and there are several communities in the country, maybe we can talk later, that are really taking up this mantra and working not only in the healthcare sector, but also with nonprofits and local businesses to make this, to operationalize this concept. And so government does not need to sit at the center of this. Everyday Americans can.
Lauren A. Taylor is my guest. She's a presidential scholar of public health and medical ethics at Harvard Divinity School and co-author, along with Elizabeth H. Bradley, of the new book, The American Healthcare Paradox, Why Spending More is Getting Us Less. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or tweet me at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Lauren A. Taylor, a presidential scholar of public health and medical ethics at Harvard Divinity School and a former program manager at the Yale Global Health Leadership Institute. She's co-author of the new book, The American Healthcare Paradox, Why Spending More is Getting Us Less. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. You mentioned, Lauren, before the break, some of the programs that you profile in the book. One that really caught my eye was in Santa Monica, California, the Ocean Park Community Center. And one of the things that it focuses on first and foremost in taking care of its clients is housing.
Absolutely. This is a great example. Thanks for bringing it up, Chris. It's a great partnership, and I think it really shows how a more holistic approach to health need not necessarily be mediated by the government. This is a totally free of government example of how we can do this. So the case is that the hospital in Santa Monica was really struggling with a barrage of what they called frequent flyers, meaning people who are very high utilizers of care. And this was largely a homeless population or a population that struggled with finding stable housing for over a long term. And they would come into the hospital primarily through the emergency department, as I mentioned earlier, looking for shelter, sometimes really ill, either having, you know, a mental health challenge or, you know, accidents happen when you live on the street. And they would come in, require a lot of time and resources of the healthcare staff. Many were uninsured, so the hospital was actually kind of eating, if you will, or paying for the cost of that care. And then they would be discharged essentially back out to the street, which, of course, was a dangerous place to be healing. Often they didn't have access to the follow-up care they needed. Wounds would get infected, and so they would come right back into the emergency department. And so in observing this phenomena, the folks at the hospital said, you know what, there has to be a better way. And they reached out to a community center that had real expertise in working with this population, and it's called the Ocean Park Community Center, OPCC. And between the community center and the hospital, they set up a partnership such that when these folks came into the hospital, no longer did they need to be treated and discharged back to the street. Now, when the ED staff saw them, they called the community center, they treated the folks, and they made sure that that person could be discharged directly to the community center where they could stay overnight, probably for several nights. There was an on-site nurse at the community center paid for by the hospital, and they were able to get the care they needed in a safe environment. This kind of partnership saved, and it was very small to begin with. The data that we worked with was just from the first year, which was 2009, I believe, and it was only about 10 or 12 patients, so small, definitely. But the hospital was able to save over $300,000 year over year, comparing 2008, when they did not have this partnership in place, to 2009. So this is real savings that the hospital said, you know, was a no-brainer. You know, it was a matter of really aligning the staff at the emergency department and the hospital more broadly and the community center and saying, we're committed to providing a higher quality of care for these people and saving money down the road in the healthcare system. So I think that's a great example, and I would love to talk more about it if anyone has questions, of how we can really embrace this broader view of health and take seriously the fact that where you live is important to how well you're feeling and how much healthcare you consume.
In terms of a broader view of health, there's also the documented fact that we spend a huge amount of overall lifetime healthcare dollars in the last months of most people's lives. The majority of the money that will be ever be spent on them is spent then. What I mean, could we change things and still, you know, take care of people at the end of life if we invested some of that money up front on either health services or social services that could perhaps keep them healthier longer?
Sure. And I think that this is really the same issue that manifests itself in many hot button topics. So, you know, frequent flyers are written about often as a major cost center for the healthcare sector. And so that OPCC example is one where the frequent flyer issue, if you will, was trying to be addressed. The exorbitant cost of end of life is another one where there's a kind of a natural process going on, and we've really intensely medicalized it. We've said, okay, we're going to throw every healthcare resource we have. And so that, of course, ends up being a ton. Whereas we could take less medical approaches to handling this, this kind of dying process. We could engage with palliative care or hospice care, which have been shown to, in many cases, be less expensive and develop and deliver higher quality. So again, it's about looking outside of the medical system, or in some cases, just less medicalized approaches to responding to health challenges that I think can really expand the toolkit and potentially deliver better care with lower cost.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. Mike is on the line in Fort Worth. Hello, Mike.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
You all have used the language a number of times that's in the title of the book, the whole healthcare system. My question is, how did that come to be the label, since in fact, if it was an accurate label, it would be a sickness care system that we're talking about, and that we spend a tremendous amount of money on sickness care, and I think the point of your whole book, if I understand it, is that we spend very little comparatively on health care, but we think we're spending this huge amount, so why spend more? What would prevent the hospitals from relabeling themselves and the Affordable Care Act, in fact, being the Affordable Sickness Care Act, for example, and just making a huge move toward language? I think it's very powerful.
Really interesting idea, Mike. Thanks for your call.
Yes, thank you so much, Mike. And I think you've completely understood the key message of the book. And I entirely agree with you that language is really important. I don't know how we could, I mean, start a movement to term it a sickness care system. I am happy to use that language because I think it is right on the money. But I think part of that comes from a larger debate and larger discussion about really what is the healthcare system aimed at doing. And primarily it is aimed at, you know, helping to repair sick people. So it is apt. I think the other question is, you know, why could we not make this health care system into a system that really goes after health as opposed to sickness? And the question there is, again, one of incentives. You know, who makes money on actual health? Right now, not very many people. And so I think that is one of the big shifts that need to happen, where we need to, you know, use our American innovation and entrepreneurialism to come up with new schemes of making money on health, keeping people healthy and out of the healthcare system. And that's a big area, I think, that is ripe for innovation and for people to move into and make a name for themselves.
We have an email here from Althea who says, how can we get beyond political naysayers who shout about socialized medicine? And how if we were to go to a system like Canada's, for instance, we would all be waiting in lines and suffering because there are long waits for surgical procedures. Althea says, I've read the statistics on medical systems around the world, and of the developed countries, ours is clearly the worst.
It's a great question. And it's one, of course, that I am just bumping into almost every day now. So I have great empathy. You know, it's important, I think, to recognize that our healthcare system, in my view, is neither the best nor the worst. I think both of those are somewhat hyperbolic. And so I think moving the discussion to a more nuanced place would mean saying, look, there are things it does well. And the things it does well are intensely medical fixes for people. So we have more people in the United States who live with knee replacements than anywhere else in the world. Hip replacements, same thing. On kidney dialysis, you know, these are intensely medical interventions that people, quite frankly, can make money on. And so we deliver them swiftly and you know, at high volume. Where we don't do so well is these broader population health outcomes that I spoke about before, the maternal mortality, the life expectancy, the infant mortality. And so there are trade-offs here, right? And I think the question is, do we want to really make an effort to shift the system to address health and therefore tackle these population health outcomes like the life expectancy and the infant mortality? Or are we comfortable with a sickness care system, as Mike said earlier? And of course, I feel that these health outcomes are certainly worth our energies in tackling. But that's where I think the real bifurcation happens when you have these very partisan debates. You know, everyone, of course, can argue about process and this legislation or that legislation. But often I think what goes unsaid is, you know, what should the goal of the healthcare system be? And I think there are some people who feel that the healthcare system should make money, and that's a goal. If that's the goal, the system is working beautifully. If the goal is health, the system is not working so beautifully. And so really clarifying what the goal is and what the ends are that we're trying to chase, I think is key in getting to a more sophisticated debate.
We have an email here from Rabbi Nancy Kasten who says, I see you're affiliated with Harvard Divinity School. What do you see as the role of the faith community in using our healthcare dollars more effectively to achieve better health for Americans?
Great question. You know, I think faith communities have such a role, particularly in kind of the Bible Belt and the South, where they have such a a leadership role in communities. And these are many of the states and communities that are really suffering in the most concrete ways from the inadequacies of the current system. You know, you have very high uninsured populations and very, very sick people all over the South. So certainly in the North, too. But faith communities, I think, can take a lead by opening up the discussion and being, I think, a little bit more political. You know, I think healthcare is a political issue. There's no way around that because it's about a common pool of resources and how you divide them. But I think it's also a deeply ethical issue and a question of to whom do we owe what? And I think, for me, we owe each other the right to health, but also as I said earlier, you know, even if you eschew that argument, I think it's in our own interest because our pocketbooks will do better over the long term by taking up this responsibility.
What obligation do you see belonging to private employers who have a vested interest in maintaining a healthy workforce? Should they feel obligated to pay a living wage?
Yeah, this isn't really a point that I have thought a ton about or discussed at length in the book, but certainly I think it's in private business owners' interest to keep their workforce healthy. You know, an unhealthy workforce is one that's absent, that probably works less effectively. An unhealthy workforce is one that may actually cost you a lot of money in health insurance if you're paying for that over the long term. So I think it is in private business owners' interest to keep their workforce healthy. But I won't say too much more about that. It's not my area, so I don't want to, you know, offend or misrepresent.
Okay. For the programs that you profile in the book that are working well, and there's a couple on the East Coast and a couple on the West Coast, and surely they're just an example of many programs that exist, what are the impediments to scaling those, to spreading them to other communities, and to making them work for a greater percentage of the American population?
Yeah, there are many, unfortunately. And many of them rest in the incentive structure that I talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. You know, what we saw in these localized examples was a real sense of community stewardship from both parties and this idea that we need to do better for kind of our brethren and our community members. And so a willingness to take risks in some circumstances and go beyond what's required of you. So, you know, the hospital doesn't necessarily need to go out of its way to forge this partnership. It takes someone's time to make those calls and set up planning meetings, etc. But I think they would say that time and the expense of that time was certainly recouped once they saw that they were able to relieve the pressure on their ED in the way that they were. So, you know, as Mike said earlier, we just have this system that is rigged to reward the care of sick people. And these four examples that we profile really kind of turn that whole paradigm on its head and say, how can we pay for keeping people healthy? And, you know, it's difficult. I think we're going to call on these case examples to exhibit real leadership in talking about their models down the line. We tried to do that with the book in the hopes of kind of creating a larger change in the political system so that hopefully we can use the ACA as a platform to move towards an orientation that's focused really on health.
The new book by Lauren A. Taylor, written with co-author Elizabeth H. Bradley, is called The American Healthcare Paradox: Why Spending More is Getting Us Less. Lauren, thank you so much for making time for us today.
Oh, thank you, Chris. It was my pleasure.
Lauren joined us from the studios of Harvard University as part of KERA's Breakthroughs Initiative. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had Christina Martinez on phones today. Christine McConnell prepares our podcast. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.